Zach Brown, congratulations with the launch of the McLaren MCLHY. You must be very proud as you prepare to enter the WEC and return to endurance racing at the top level.
Yeah, well, McLaren has a rich history at Le Mans and other great endurance races. And, you know, we're aiming to really challenge the existing teams with a very competitive race car.
Many people have noticed your car looks very similar to the Ferrari 499P. Is it just a copy?
Well, it is true that both cars have a Dallara chassis and a 3-liter twin turbocharged V6, all built in Italy, and certain aerodynamic similarities, of course, driven by the rule set. There is one major difference in concept with our car that means it is completely different from the Scuderia's car.
And what is that?
Their car is red. Ours is orange.
Hello, welcome to Gareth Jones on Speed. I'm Gareth. Joining us later on will be Alex Goy, because he's been driving some very interesting cars. And I say joining us because with me right now is the ever faithful Zob.
Hello.
Hey Z, how are you, bruv?
Getting by, thank you.
Ever faithful, Zog, you're always there. You've been there since the very dawn. You are the reason for the existence of this podcast. And you're still enabling me, this addiction I have to podcasting. You're my enabler.
Still hammering away, so we'll keep it going, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, we've still got stuff to talk about, you know, this stuff evolving in Formula One and road cars at an incredible rate. Listen, I've got to tell you this story first before we get into the meat and two veg of cars. I went to the Machynlleth Comedy Festival over the weekend.
Sorry, the what comedy festival?
Machynlleth. It's a town in mid Wales.
Okay.
In Dyfed. And it's a little old market town, but they have this amazing comedy festival. It takes over the whole town. They have thousands of people camping. They have a big festival, big top, and bands play and comedians perform. It's great. And the food, oh, it was wonderful. Good vibe, really good vibe. And Stuart Lee was performing. And I'm connected to Stuart Lee in a number of ways. And so I was put on the guest list for this show because Stuart Lee has got a routine at the moment of which people have been contacting me. They've been seeing his show, Stuart Lee versus the Man Wolf, all over the country. And people message me to go, you know, Stuart Lee's talking about you in his show.
Okay.
Right, okay. So I went along to see what he does. And he knew I was in the audience. He knew I was coming. And I was wondering what he was going to do. Is he just going to avoid it? Was it just be embarrassing and weird if I'm there and he does this routine? Or what, will he change it for someone else? What will happen? And he explains, he was doing this routine on stage about how, you know, who do we think we are, right? You know, the people in our heads, the same people that we project. And, you know, for years I believed I looked like Gaz Top because whenever I looked in the mirror, I looked like Gaz Top. Then I realised Gaz Top actually lived next door to me and he cut in a serving hatch between our two walls. So I was actually looking at Gaz Top. Now, that's partly true because we did live not next door to each other, but opposite each other, around the corner.
Yeah, you lived close to each other in Stoke Newington. As I recall, there was some occasion that one of you had to leave a note on the other's windshield because you'd bumped into them or something like that.
Well, remembered, correct. Yeah, I took his wing mirror off by accident one
day
in the narrow streets of London. It was a long story. I owned up to it. But yeah, we kind of sort of made contact at that point and vaguely know each other. So he did this routine on stage. And then he stopped the routine and he said, and I believe Gaz Top, which is apparently me, is in tonight. And so I had to sort of put my hand up in this comedy room and own up. And we had a hilarious conversation about living next door to each other or near each other in Stoke Newington and really local stuff. But what was really wonderful was that he flagged up the fact that I've just made two radio documentaries for BBC Radio Wales, which have gone out now. The second one went out Monday.
A couple of days ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, last week and today, the two episodes. Yeah. And he mentioned that, which I thought was very kind of him. What a kind man to take that opportunity to talk about a programme that's very important to me and very important to Wales and very important to Alarm fans. So I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, this is your two-part show remembering Mike Peters, lead singer of The Alarm, who sadly passed away not long ago.
Exactly. Yeah, 12 months ago and a few days. It was made to mark the anniversary of his passing, and really pleased with it. And I don't think I could have made that programme without having made this podcast for 21 years. All the skills that I learned to make this directly transfer to making that programme, and it was a joy to make. It's very difficult to make. It's very personal. I had to reflect the truth. Yeah. But anyway, sorry, I had to tell you that. But
Good.
We're still doing this podcast because there's still interesting stuff happening on track.
Absolutely.
Because I was at the Machynlleth Comedy Festival in the middle of a field, I missed a lot of the action early on in the weekend. Didn't see qualifying. Well, I did see Q2 and Q3 briefly on a phone, and I did watch most of the sprints, but I had to go to an event. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to watch the sprints, but it was quite the weekend, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, having been deprived of racing action for a few weeks by the cancellation of those two Grand Prix, I guess our anticipation is a little bit higher. Plus, they've changed a lot of the rules. Quite a novelty for mid-season to have technical changes in the middle of the season. But, you know, there was very broad agreement that something should be done. So there's anticipation because of that as well.
Yeah. Interesting, joke. They built those rules in a very adaptive way because different energy recovery and deployment rules apply on different circuits.
A different circuit. Right.
So they had a kind of a modular structure, which did allow them. There were precedents in which they could make changes, and I think they were well advised to do it. Did they do enough? Did they do too much? What do you think?
For me, jury's still out. You know, this is just one race with the new rules. I think, you know, we need to see more than just one race, but I'm cautiously optimistic. I think, first of all, less whinging and complaining from the drivers, so that suggests that they've gone in the right direction. And, you know, there was none of the to and fro, A takes B, B takes A, A takes B, B takes A, passing and repassing between two drivers that we've seen too much of in that opening phase of the season.
Yeah, there was still plenty of that, but not the scale that we've seen before.
If there was any of that kind of, well, yo-yo racing, as I think one of, was it Lando's engineer said something about, let them get on with their yo-yo racing,
he
you
did.
Sit behind. And
yeah.
It was less of that yo-yo racing and perhaps a bit more of a situation where that repass would happen a lap later rather than a couple of corners later.
Yeah.
Or at least that was the way it seemed to me. Like I say, we need more data. We've got to see some more racing, see them racing in a variety of circuits before we can really get a clearer picture. But yeah, it looked better to me. And we had three different leaders early in the race, which suggests that, you know, they're doing good things and they're not making the racing any harder. So yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, the race itself. My first observation is that the Red Bull rotating rear wing seems to be a more elegant solution than the Ferrari, they call it Macarena wing. I don't like that. I think the Red Bull system of rotating 180 degrees as opposed to going the long way around like Ferrari does seems to me to be more efficient.
I mean, they're both doing a 180-degree rotation. Sure.
Yeah.
It's just that one of them sort of is going
forward, and the other goes backwards.
Clockwise, and the other's going anti-clockwise, looking for the same side of the car.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Towards the front of the car from the top or from the bottom. That's what it does. The way that Red Bull have it configured, to me, looks a bit more efficient because you get the slam-down effect under braking, which brings in the braking more quickly and harder, I would think, which is what you want. Because in F1, it's either no brakes or all the brakes. whereas the Ferrari system has to sort of fight against it because of the position that it's rotating in. The whole idea of doing this is brilliant, and it hadn't occurred to me that there was an even better way than Ferrari doing it, in my view. But I think the Red Bull one is a better engineering solution.
I wonder. I mean, I honestly don't think that either you or I have enough engineering or aerodynamic knowledge, you know, by any means, to just eyeball that wing in a practice or in a race and going, no, actually, it would work better if you did this. No, we don't know that. Those guys, you know,
they know.
Those engineers have spent a lot of time on it, and they know an awful lot more about what they're doing in that field than we do. So I don't know which way around is going to work better.
I tell you what, you know? Though, those engineers have done a good job, right? But no one has come up with the correct nomenclature for this sort of thing yet. And so I'm suggesting one. I think if you're sort of applying kind of NASA approach to terminology, this would be the rear wing upper element inversion system. The RWUEIS, the rear wing upper element inversion system.
Yep.
Because that's what it does. It inverts the upper element of the rear wing. I've called it the flipping wing because it flips from one to the other. I like that, the flipping wing, but it's a bit, you know, not too techy. It's an inverter, but that's confusing because inverters are used in
electrical
systems.
Things.
Yeah. You could call it a roto wing, because it rotates, but that's confusing with gyroplanes, right? Rotor plane.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Yeah.
And so I've settled on a term I don't think it's been used anywhere. I haven't done a search online, but I would suggest that this type of rear wing is an inverter foil.
Inverter foil. Yeah, not bad. Okay, how about the magic wing? Magic wing.
That works. We know what we're talking about.
Maybe we're overselling it a little, but
well, as we know, any technology sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Was that Asimov or was that Arthur C. Clarke?
Arthur C. Clarke, I think. Inverter foil. I'm going to go with that because it's only one foil, one element of the wing, one aerofoil that inverts.
My objection to that term, my first objection is that, as we've already noted, an inverter is an electrical device.
Yeah.
Inverter foil sounds like some kind of metal foil that you might use either in or on the surface of an inverter. So I don't think it's a great name.
Okay. You think that's confusing?
Keep thinking
about it. We'll come back to that. Those of you listening, if you've got any ideas, please let us know. I want to open this up. I'd love to know. But if you think that's confusing, here's some name confusion for you. What happens if you swap the first names of teammates? You get some really interesting combinations. I'll start at the back with the confusing Sergio Bottas.
Sergio Bottas.
Where could he be from? Yeah. Sergio Bottas.
He'd have to be Brazilian. That would be for you.
Yeah, Sergio Bottas.
Yeah, that's a kind of Brazilian combo.
With Finnish roots, You get great alliteration with Liam Lindblad.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, strong name.
That's like Lana Lang, Lois Lane, Lex Luthor, you know. The best one I'm going to save, but I quite like the idea of Fernando Stroll.
Yes. Okay.
And of course, the very, very English Charles Hamilton.
Oh, yeah. Oh, crikey.
Yeah.
Yeah, that totally missed a trick there. Blimey. Yeah. So you could have Charles Hamilton and Lewis Leclerc. Nice bit of alliteration there.
But the absolute best one of the whole bunch is the teammate of Esteban Behrman, Ollie Ocon.
Okay, excellent.
Ollie Ocon. It sounds like something from an old nursery rhyme in the 40s.
Exactly. Or some sort of, you know, I don't know, hunting song.
Yeah.
Ollie Ocon free.
Exactly. Yeah. I just don't know why that came to me the other day. We'll talk about the racing in a moment. A couple of other things. Hooray. You know how much I hate the blue on the Ferrari, the HP blue. I think it's got no business on that car. How dare they? Right? The only blue allowed on a Ferrari is the word Fiat. in the old 1970s blue Fiat logo, in my view.
Okay, that's a pretty hard line you're holding there. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Well, there have to be rules, Og. There has to be.
Of course. I agree. Yeah, you've got to have rules. Yeah, you've got to have rules. Are we living in the jungle or something? Yeah. You've got to have rules.
It's just anarchy. However, what I'm going to say is that the fact that Charles Leclerc wore a Miami pale blue helmet, his helmet was coloured like the sky in Miami, this beautiful blue, introduced a bit of blue into the cockpit and suddenly made that blue on the Ferrari acceptable for the first time. Oh, that was it. Were Cadillac actually there that weekend? Did you see a Cadillac on screen ever?
I mean, hardly. I did see a little bit of them trailing around at the back along with Aston Martin.
At one point, I think Perez was running 12th or 14th, possibly, somewhere, not quite in the points, but they were racing. But the reason I say were Cadillac there was that they had a special livery for this race, as did Racing Bullocks. And no one really got to see the Cadillac livery because no one would even notice the difference because we barely see the Cadillacs anyway. I don't really know what the Cadillac livery looks like in detail because they never appear on screen. Their sponsors must be going nuts because they measure everything, don't they? Airtime.
My quick thing is, well, you know, it's basically the monochrome car.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
There's colour everywhere else, and you know, the Cadillac's the one that doesn't have all that colour on it. That's
the reddest spot.
That's how you plot the Cadillac.
The Racing Bollocks are great in that yellow.
They did actually, yeah. And then you also noticed them because they kept bumping into people.
Yes, there was a lot of that.
I thought the Lawson on Gasly was a bit. What did you make of that?
I rate Lawson. I think he's great. I think it was unfortunate. I don't know the situation why he managed to tip him. They were just sharing the same piece of track and it's a narrow track.
Yeah.
But it looked dramatic because of the way that it flipped and then he skated along inverted and settled at an uncomfortable angle on the barrier there. You know, it could have been nasty. I mean, what's your view? Liam's fault? Yeah.
I think it was. I mean, I don't think he was, you know, reckless. Yeah, but in that moment of trying to defend the place, I think he misjudged it and slid wide and tipped Gasly over in the process. That's how it looked to me. Not a massive cock up, but it was. It looked like it was Lawson's fault. Shame for Gasly.
Audi must be tearing their hair out. They failed to start the sprint, didn't they? Hulk failed to start the sprint.
Yeah.
And isn't it grey? All that Audi's grey. It's slate grey, I noticed. Maybe it's the first time I've seen it in UHD. I've been watching it in HD. And it really reads as a very dark, sinister, almost stealth car. The Audi, I like that.
Yeah, they're doing a great job. And I like seeing Alan McNish out and about doing his thing for Audi. His time with Audi in endurance racing at Le Mans, you know, makes him an absolute all-time legend of the sport.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so to have an absolute superstar there involved in their day-to-day racing at the tracks, that's a great element for Audi to have in their race machine there, I think. And
he's a smart guy. He was sort of captain or team principal of the Audi Abt Formula E team.
Formula E, yeah,
for
he
a
was.
While,
yeah,
I
yeah,
believe,
right.
as well.
Yeah.
He's a great guy. I've met him. I don't know if you've met him, but I've encountered him
briefly a couple of times.
He's a cool, real, lively, enthusiastic guy. So nice to have him around still. He's earned it.
Top fella.
I said we talk about the racing. We have to mention Kimi Antonelli's rise, which is kind of like the Artemis launch, isn't it? From 0 to 100 in three races. He's there, isn't he?
And of course, commentators were talking on Saturday about how impressive it was that Antonelli's pole position meant that he was the only driver apart from Senna and Schumacher to have claimed their first three pole positions at consecutive events. But after the race, you know, Antonelli was the only one of those three drivers to turn all three of those consecutive poles into consecutive wins. So he's, you know, he's excelling in very rarefied company. That's a hell of a performance.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean he's going to carry on looking that stellar all the time. But crikey, yeah, what a performance. What a further validation for Toto Wolff and Mercedes in picking Kimi Antonelli as their next big thing. He is delivering.
And these cars, as all F1 cars are, very difficult to drive. Take, for instance, Charles Leclerc, who spun in the last few laps of the race. You know, he was right on the edge to get maximum performance out of that car in just that one moment, completely spun and damaged one side of the car, limped across the line, lost its place to George and Max, who got ahead of him. Heartbreaking stuff. Yeah. But that's what you want in the last few laps of a race. It doesn't need to be a done deal. It's like it could change all the way up to the line. Miami delivered that in bucket loads. You had Max spinning early on in the Grand Prix and then recovering. You know, what a drive. Max is happier. Was he complaining? Not really. You know?
Yeah, no, he seemed to be much, much happier with the car. That's a good thing. And yeah, Greg, he was lucky that he got away with his spin early on. I mean, it was extraordinary that he managed to get away without hitting anybody or not pointing in the same direction with that lap one spin. As you say, Max seemed a lot happier with the car. He was, you know, able to race better this weekend and bodes well for the next phase of the season. One of the big takeaways for me was how solid McLaren's improvement was.
Yeah.
Because whether they've figured out a bit more of what Mercedes are able to do to extract the best from
recovery their powertrain.
Yeah. And they've just been able to figure out what it is that Mercedes were doing differently with the same power unit that meant that Mercedes were so much quicker in those first three races. Or whether it's aero work as well, who knows? Both.
Yeah, it'll be a little bit of everything.
They've done a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
And McLaren are very, very good at improving their car.
As we saw last year, and it's consistent. They are top form. Well, it's 2 weeks to Canada. I had to rush back from the Chunklef Comedy Festival. I couldn't stick around for the second half of Stuart Lee's performance because they brought the Miami Grand Prix forward by 3 hours.
Yeah.
So I had to tear back to go and watch it at my friend Gwyn's house. And Gwyn and Brandon and Hugh and I all watched the race together. And it was proper entertainment. So, yeah, Canada next in terms of racing. But next on the programme, Alex Goyer, who's been driving some fast cars. Usually in this part of the programme we have a sketch, but not in this episode. Instead, I want to take the opportunity to mark the passing of Alex Zanardi. Many of us know the story of how Zanardi had several bites at Formula One, but always in teams that were uncompetitive at the time. He ultimately made his name racing in IndyCar, or kart. He lost both his legs in an horrific racing accident at the Lausitzring in 1999, but then went on to be a world-beating Paralympic athlete after heroically returning to motor racing, where he won once again. His determination and resilience in the face of adversity was an inspiration to everyone. But when I think of Alex Zanardi, my mind goes to a kart World Series race in 1996, when Zanardi was chasing Brian Herta for the win at Laguna Seca. Zanardi passed Herta on the last lap by diving past the leader with a lunge on the corkscrew. This is arguably the most challenging corner on any race circuit in the world. Not usually an overtaking zone in any way. Zanardi's lunge saw him pop past Herta with an audacious move that used the runoff area and is the single wildest, bravest piece of motor racing I think I may have ever seen. It was fantastic. Please look up a clip of that move on YouTube. I'll put a link to it on the page for this episode of the podcast on my website, garethjones.tv. Riposa in pace. We'll miss you, Alessandro.
Gareth Jones on speed!
and as if by magic, because any science sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic, joining us now is Alex Goy. Hey, big boy, how you doing?
Hi, friends. I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm fab, as discussed earlier on the programme, but I've got a question for you. Mm. You've had a massive sort of change of work status recently, haven't you?
Yes, a little bit. I'm not really a freelancer anymore. I am now the creative director at Drive Tribe. You might remember a few years ago, kicking off with Clarkson Hammond Domain. It's gone through many, many, many evolutions since then. And now it's sort of primarily a YouTube venture. So, yeah, I'm doing the creative at that now, which is really fun. I just went in for a meeting about scripts and then it sort of snowballed.
Fantastic. You're like a producer, effectively, executive producer there, is that right?
Scripts and organising stuff.
What would be the term?
I don't really know. I people ask me for my opinion on things and then they believe it.
Creative director is the correct term, I think.
Yes, that's kind of it. So yeah, it's booking stuff in and writing scripts and deciding what direction we're going to go, which is very exciting. Early days, yeah. This is week 4 we're recording in now. So yeah, the first week sort of went by in a rush and second week I was very confused and last week I was sort of more on an even keel. I'm finally kind of figuring out where the loos are. And this week there's stuff I can't really talk about yet, but lots of filming in lots of places, which is very exciting.
And it does mean that you're still in very close contact with lots of interesting cars.
Yes, well, I'm still allowed to do freelance stuff as well, because I'm allowed to write for people. So especially while I'm sort of starting, I've got a few clients that I said, I'll drive this for you, and it's sort of interfering with work time. So I've been out and about having some fun in things, and I'm going to be out and about having other fun in other things, but this is the fun I can talk about.
Can we talk about one of your fun cars, which I'm intrigued by? You've been driving Twisted Land Rovers.
Yes, I have. So Twisted, if you're not familiar with them, formed in sort of turn of the century times by a chap called Charles Fawcett. Very lovely man. He was working at a sort of off-road experience site and his dad was in the biz. And he started selling sort of parts for Land Rovers. And then it kind of snowballed when he started putting parts on Land Rovers and then selling Land Rovers with his bits on them. And the Twisted cars, I mean, I first encountered them, I think it must be a decade ago now, probably a bit longer, because we did a film on them for Carfection, just because we were in the area, because they're in Thirsk in Yorkshire. Yeah. So we were up filming a Bristol Fighter for the two preceding days. And we thought, well, while we're up, we may as well say hello. So we went up and we had a natter and they took us for a ride in one. It was all very sweet. What they do with their Defenders, at least, is they basically make them not rubbish. So the steering works, for example. Because at the time, we had a Defender as a crew car. So we were doing lots of Defender-based content to kind of justify the loan. And yeah, we had this Defender and driven it all the way up to Thirsk and it was, yeah, not great. And then we had a go in one of theirs that had a V8 in it and the steering worked and the panels fit and it was quiet inside. There was sound insulation and there was no wobbly trim or anything like that. It sounded great, handled great. The suspension wasn't wibbly wobbly. I mean, it was still a Defender, so your elbow still had to be like up in the air to be comfortable. But they were really good. I mean, they're not cheap things. At the time, it was about 100 grand if you wanted to keep your 2-litre diesel in it, I think. And then if you wanted more than that, if you wanted the LT V8s and all that, there would be more money. I sort of kept an eye on their continued existence, but I'd not really paid too close attention.
Can I ask, how do they operate? I know he bought a huge number of the run-out Land Rovers.
Yes.
And he also, does he buy VIN numbers? Do you supply a donor car? Will they supply a donor car for you? How does it work?
There's some donor car shenanigans going on. I think there's also some sort of sourced cars from all over the place. He's saying like they do have loads of the original Land Rover, like kind of legit off the line ones, but he says they don't tend to use them that much. So they're all just there somewhere. He wouldn't tell me where. But yeah, they have them still, but it's mostly people coming in going, here's my Land Rover, do this, or I've got one, or I can source one. And they have a very specific kind of thing they want out of them. Yeah, they've now got two workshops. So they've got the original lockup, which is handily right next to Thirsk Nick. So if they see someone tarossing about after hours in a Twisted car, they will be stopped very quickly because they're good mates, apparently. Yeah, that's the original one. And then they've bought something called the Old Cinema, which is just up the road as a sort of very shiny showroom. In the 1920s, it was Thirsk's Cinema.
The Gaumont.
And now, you know, they've got a big screen in it. But in the back, there's this beautiful wooden floored workshop where they're assembling some cars, which is very cool. And yeah, the business has grown. It's now sort of internationally renowned, and the kind of the engineering that goes into them is serious. It's really cool. And there are lots of businesses connected to it, so they can build different bits of cars and just keep it within the family, which is great.
I saw a video, Alex, of what they call the Old Cinema in Thirsk. It's on their website, and it's shot with a drone going through underneath vehicles, around vehicles. There's a pool table, and out the back there is an absolutely gobsmacking line of Land Rovers in all shapes, sizes and modifications. And it instantly looked like a place, oh, mate, I want to drive past there and sit down, have a cup of coffee and have a look round. It was kind of part showroom, part social centre. I mean,
It is. Right. I mean, the sad thing is they're kind of retooling their new workshop, because they had it as a social hub, but it didn't really do what they needed it to do. So you will still be able to get a coffee there. You can come and have a look, but it's not a coffee shop anymore.
Yeah,
that's not really the jam, which is a shame because they do a really good cup of tea.
So do you approve of Twisted Land Rovers? Have you seen them?
In passing, I mean, I've seen their name in print. I honestly didn't take much interest. You know, I'm not a big 4x4 off-roader guy. If you're going to have an off-roader, have a Land Rover. If you're going to go for a stupid, lumpy off-road box, get a proper, good, old-fashioned...
Yeah, off-road box.
Actually, dedicated, real, you know, chunky off-road box, and not a fancy Chelsea tractor. I can't really comment except that I like the vibe. I like, you know, and everything you're discussing about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, they sound like a fine bunch of British car geeks. All power to them.
They're all enthusiasts and they just love what they do, and they like making Land Rovers better. And now they've come out with a Range Rover Classic.
Yeah. It's called the RRC.
The RRC, there's been a few. It's quite difficult when I was up there not to compare it to some of the others, because there are a few kicking around. So Kingsley's the big one. Down in Oxfordshire.
Told us about that in the back.
Driven a few of those. They're gorgeous things. And they're sort of doing their own thing to try and upgrade them and try and make more out of them and make them, you know, not soggy rot boxes that are a bit rubbish. And Twisted is doing its own take on it. You can't really compare the two, because the Kingsley is very much about driving pleasure, but it's more sort of the luxury side of it. You want the luxury, but with a bit more power and a bit more this. Whereas the Twisted, it comes with a 6.2 litre V8 with 500 horsepower just out of the box.
Chevy engine,
doing a teardown of it. So they're taking all the bits off of it, and they're rust-proofing and everything-proofing it. But they're also doing some gentle redesigning, because obviously the cars in period are made for people on a line to put bits on and then move on to the next one. So they're quite modular. That means there were some design choices made that with these that are going to be hand-built, sort of one-off or bespoke, you don't necessarily have to make those. So they'll be able to keep the same shape or a similar shape, and they'll tweak bits. So vents that were plastic would now be metal and built in, and door handles will be made of billet rather than plastic. And bits of the front won't be modular. It'll be one thing, and the bumper on the front won't do this or that or whatever it is they do. So they're making it idealised aesthetically as well as mechanically. It's not got any sort of adaptive suspension this or anything like that. They're doing their own suspension setup. And when I drove it, they were saying the front's still a little bit hard, so they're going to soften that off a touch. But the power delivery is mega. It's a GM 8-speed gearbox mated to a GM engine, but they've done the tuning and the mapping on all of it. So it works. It shifts. It really shifts. It's quite fantastic. Right. And it's got a set of very noisy, very lovely pipes on it, which I rather enjoyed.
The colour choice on the website, you know, it's the first time I've seen that kind of BL 70s mustardy Sahara colour.
It's called Bahama Gold.
Bahama Gold. It looks gorgeous. And it really is... in the spirit of the original generation two-door.
Is this the same kind of old British Leyland colour that I would imagine a really crappy Allegro?
Yep. Yes.
Yep, it definitely evokes that. Yeah.
Yes, but on a Land Rover, it's Bahama Gold.
All right.
There's a reason for that. Charles Fawcett, the man who founded Twisted, he's got huge connection to Land Rovers because of his dad. And his dad had, in period, a Bahama Gold Range Rover that he kept doing stuff to. So he would modify this or change that and just see what would fit and what would work. But it has a huge sentimental value to him. And it's such a formative part of his automotive journey that as a result, his first, the prototype, was going to be that homage to his dad's car. So that's why it's quite that distinctive shade, because it was his dad's car, and it's his sort of nod to him of like, right, you did yours, I'll do mine. Because this car of his childhood was constantly changing. One of the things I do love about it is, you know, in the Kingsley cars and all that, you can have a screen, so you can have CarPlay and you can have nav and you can have this and have that. And in the prototype, at least, there isn't one. There's a Bluetooth stereo, but there's nowhere to put your phone other than your pocket, because he wants it to be something you get in and drive. He doesn't want you to be disconnected from the experience. As such, like, as a thing to drive, when obviously it's a Twisted car, so the steering works and it's a little bit quieter and you can hear what's going on inside the car, not mix too much what's going on outside the car, which is great. But if you want to tip it into a corner and be a bit of a lunatic, you can. If you want to floor it, you can. But you can also just use it as a tool to get around in, just free of distractions. He's very keen that it's a machine that you drive in, not a machine that you run your life in.
Yeah. Not to be lived in, which is weird, really, because a Range Rover or a Land Rover is a kind of vehicle that you ultimately can live in, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, but you can live in it, but you live in it when you stop driving.
Yeah. Poor.
You could say there's something sort of retro-ish about that, in that, you know, increasingly, you know, car manufacturers have pushed their products as lifestyle products and things you live you have your entire life in this thing. But this is, stripping back to, no, this is something that you drive. It's a machine for driving, a tool for driving. Drive it. Don't do the taxes in it.
Do you know what I love most about Twisted? I didn't know this until I was reading about it today, that a few years ago, the model of the Twisted company went to an employee shared ownership system, and they all are owners, share owners, complete owners of the company. Charles is still the MD, but I love that, because the production company I work with here in North Wales, Cwmni Dda, who made a program for me a few years ago, they're pretty much a communist collective, you might say, which is fantastic. And it kind of makes it okay, even if they're making really big, monstrous, thirsty Chelsea tractors, the fact that it's a socialist union of shareholders makes it beautiful in my view.
Hang on, so you're right. I think there's a slightly, I don't know, I'm not sure how coherent and solid a case you can make that expanding share ownership is a great socialist enterprise. There's an interesting economic political debate
discussion there.
You know, it's I think, you know, share ownership, I think, is kind of one of the key bits of your capitalist machine, surely. So if you're embarking on a communist enterprise, you don't have share ownership. I'll just throw that out there.
Shared ownership of the entire brand for every worker, and there are no other shareholders.
I am not saying it's a bad idea. No, it's a great thing. That kind of, you know, shared employee ownership is a very good thing. I'm just gently suggesting that selling this kind of share model as a great leap forward in your communist revolution is problematic.
Nicely put. Alex, you drove a Bentley of some description recently
right?
Which one now? Come on, you've driven all of them.
There are quite a few Bentleys now, but they keep selling, so they're going to keep making them.
Good.
This was the Bentley Continental GTS. Now, I need to explain the Bentley Continental lineup for you a little bit.
Go on.
You have the Bentley Continental.
Yeah.
And that comes with a 4-litre hybridised turbocharged V8 with 671 horsepower and 686 pounds and feet. Then you have...
Still not enough.
It's not enough, is it? and that, I think that's also the Continental Azure. But then you have the Continental Speed, GT Speed, and GT Mulliner. Those get 771 horsepower and a bit more torque. The base car will do 170-ish miles an hour. The speed and the Mulliner will do over 200. The Continental GTS has the base car's powertrain, so only 671 horsepower, but it's got bits off of the Continental GT speed, so it's got the magical ride things.
It's like the Sportline or GT Line version, isn't it? Where you've got all the look, but not the engine.
Kind of. Well, it's got its own look. It's got black bits and carbon bits and all that, but it gets like the proper techie toys off of the GT speed. So I think they call it the Performance Active Chassis. So it means like the wheels can do torque vectoring, and you can shift torque 100% to the rear, and basically they've taken all the stuff that makes the really fast one quite fun to drive and put it on the slightly less really fast one to make a more sort of super leggera proposition, like a 911 Carrera T, except it still weighs as much as the moon. But as such, out of that 671 horsepower, you can now do 191 miles an hour, and it'll do 0 to 60 in 3.5 seconds, which is slightly faster because it can deal with the bow more.
Still the world's fastest truck, right, Bentley?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very nice thing. They very politely flew us to the Isle of Man for it, which was quite cool.
Because there's no speed limit there, is there?
Yeah, there's no speed limit, but it's also very narrow. But we drove sort of a big chunk of the TT course, which was mega.
Yeah.
You know, the roads out there are absolutely amazing.
Aren't they? I learned to drive there.
You learned to drive there?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not completely, but in my early days of driving, I used to go on holiday to the Isle of Man with my dad flying radio-controlled aircraft in a national competition that went there every year. And we used to go to a pub on the other side of the island, and I had L plates. And my dad really wasn't a drinker, and of course I was 17 at the time, so I wasn't drinking. So dad would have like a half of lager or something like that, and would announce that he was too drunk to drive home. So he would sit in the passenger seat and I would drive home an L plate. So yeah, I know those roads from Cregnan Bar, from Peel, from Douglas. I know the Isle of Man. I know Castletown. Love it. Love the Isle of Man. Great to drive.
I've never been before. I found it quite strange because obviously I'm a London boy.
Yeah.
So there's no skyscrapers. It's a third of the size of Greater London, which I found quite bizarre when I looked it up earlier. The architecture out there is quite mega, because somewhere will look like quaint little village.
Yeah.
Somewhere will look a bit sort of
medieval,
30s-y.
Yeah,
somewhere will look 70s-y.
Yeah, a lot.
And then you've got these people who are like splashing the cash and have like the most incredible architecture in the world.
Yeah.
And then Douglas looks like a seaside town.
Yes.
It's very architecturally bizarre, beautiful. It feels like someone's imagined a bit of the British countryside and drawn it from memory.
Geologically equally mixed up as well, because it is literally made of the same elements as parts of Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales. Very interesting geological place, the Isle of Man. And culturally, again, it's a mixture of Scouse, Scottish, North Wales and Irish. You know, it is the very core of the British Celtic mix, I suppose. Suppose you could say, really.
Yeah,
mainly goidelic.
Yeah, it was very odd. But it was well, not in a bad way. It was just odd.
So a Bentley.
Yes, there was a Bentley. It's a Bentley Continental GT, so it's not going to be rubbish, is it? It was. It's not going to be rubbish, is it? Car itself, I've been lucky enough to drive a Speed before, and the Speed is needlessly quick. This is also needlessly quick, but the steering is absolutely gorgeous in it, so you can like feel everything under the front, but it's not overwhelming. The punch of it, I mean, if anyone says 671 horsepower is too much, they've got something wrong with them, really, because that's not too much. That's enough. That's more than enough, frankly. That's more than enough power.
Adequate.
Yes, it's adequate. It's adequate.
That's what Rolls-Royce would say, wouldn't it?
There's the comfort mode, which makes it all wafty, and then the Bentley mode, which mixes everything, and then the sport mode, which makes it a bit harder and a bit faster. But it's the sort of car you could get in and go, you know what, this just does everything and will do everything for me to the end of time. Because it's so beautifully appointed. It looks the absolute business, and it chuffing goes. And the fact you can plug it in and drive it round electrically if you'd like to. When I was going round at some speeds electrically, which was most pleasant.
Has it got something like 50-mile range on electric only?
Oh, something like that. Yeah. I'd have to look
probably
that up.
30.
It's got some miles.
Yeah.
It will do some miles. It's the sort of thing where they've done what they probably should have done in the first place, but now if you've got a Continental, you have an excuse to buy the next one with the S-Pack on it.
Well, you've made it a very difficult choice for me now, you
I know,
see.
I'm sorry. I mean, if you feel you really need the ultra personalisation that one gets with a Mulliner spec vehicle, I'm sure if you ask nicely, they do it with that powertrain in it. But otherwise...
It's practically named after me, not the Mulliner, but the other, the GT Speed. It's the gas top on Speed. It's almost, really. I should buy that ruddy car. I would love to have seen a fleet of Bentleys wafting and storming around...
What do we call it?
A Nismanow in Welsh. What do you call it in Manx? What's the...
The Isle of Man.
No, Ellen Vanin. Ellen Vanin in Manx. That's what it's called. I can't believe it.
Right.
Speak a bit of Manxcoidelic. Well, say the name of the place.
I learned something today. I think they had 6 or 7, maybe 8 cars out there all doing the same route, and it was quite the thing. It really was. Like, I made sure to go last because people are going to drive faster than me, and I was there to take nice pictures and have a nice time. Just these things herring around, and some of them had Akrapovic exhausts on them, so they sounded like NASCARs. They were quite incredible.
Really? Really? Bentleys that go raw? Where, how many monies are they? You know.
Some monies, couple hundred thousand and a bit.
Yeah.
Big monies, lots of monies.
220 monies. Yeah.
If one has to ask.
Yeah, isn't that a Rolls Royce question again? I think we're blurring it here.
It's sort of anything expensive.
Luxury goods in general.
Yes.
And you can't tell us what you're going to do next because it's probably a world secret, isn't it?
I can't tell you what I'm going to do next, mostly because I haven't done it yet and I don't know what's going to happen. I do know what it is, but I haven't done it yet. But next week I'm doing 3 shoots with 4 cars, which considering the plan was to do 1 film a month, keep my hand in, that's not happening. So
3 films a month's a lot, actually. It really is. It's a lot.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. It's been a joy so far to write for the people I've been writing for and to see that happen and it all come together. The team there is really good.
Great.
And I'm excited to make things, frankly. But yes, the upcoming things, hopefully I'll have some really interesting cars to talk about in the next couple of weeks.
Brilliant.
Well, we'll look forward to the next couple of weeks, Alex.
If I'm in the country, which, yeah. Who knows? This time last week, I didn't know I was going to Germany tomorrow. So.
Good. It's nice to have a bit of spontaneous chaos in your life.
Yes.
It's good for you. Right, it's good for you. But for now, Alex, nice to hear you, brother. Thank you.
Thanks, friends. Love you. Bye.
Bye. And Zogga, great to see you too, man.
Good catching up with you both.
Yep. See you both in a fortnight. And you guys listening, you can hear us in a fortnight. Say bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you enjoyed this show, then please like, share and subscribe. For information on how to contact the show, see pictures, read song lyrics, follow us on social media, or to sponsor this podcast, go to garethjones.tv. Gareth Jones on Speed is made in Wales by Whiz Bang.
Gareth Jones on Speed!